Just wrapped up an interview with Henrik, who is a former US Marine and CEO of a company, of a huge company. And what an amazing guy, man. He's a man of honor. I told him at the interview, at the end of the interview, that he's a man of honor. And I haven't told this to anyone, I think, in my entire life. So the world definitely needs more people like him, more entrepreneurs like him. Amazing, amazing story. Coming to the U.S. without speaking a word of English, going and becoming a U.S. Marine, and then doing his entrepreneurial journey. That's definitely something you guys want to listen to. And before you do, don't forget, support us in getting the word out there. Like, subscribe, and share the interview on wherever you're listening to it. And yeah, I hope you guys enjoy the show. Entrepreneurs Podcast, where our mission is to inspire, impact, and influence other immigrant entrepreneurs to follow their dreams and create the future they want. My guest today is the ex-US Marine and the CEO of Barbecue Galore, Henrik Stepanian. Henrik, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ali. I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
Did I say everything right?
Except one thing.
Tell me.
With the Marines, it's never an ex-Marine, it's a former Marine.
I'm sorry.
No, okay. It's like, with Marines, Army is ex, Navy is ex, Air Force is ex-Marine, but we're a little more stuck up and we say
okay.
Former.
Okay. Thanks for telling me that. So, Henrik, tell me about, so you were not born in the US, which is also very unique, you know? Me having lived in Switzerland for a long time and also being a U.S. citizen. Well, at the time you become a Swiss citizen, you can go serve for military. But a lot of people don't do it because at the time when they become a Swiss citizen, it's already too late. But we will get there. So how it works in the U.S. So yeah, man, tell us, where were you born and when did you come to the U.S.?
I was born in a little town called Ararat, Armenia. I came to the U.S. when I was 10 years old. My parents were actually born in Iran.
And oh,
then,
wow.
Yeah, they went to Armenia and then met over there, got married, you know, had three of the four kids in Armenia. And then we came to the U.S. in 1988 when I was 10 years old. We landed here on June 10th, 1988. I'll never forget that. So,
where? In L.A.?
In L.A. We went from Armenia to Russia for a couple of weeks, Italy for about a week. And then Pan Am Airlines from Italy to New York to Los Angeles.
Wow, what a journey. By the way, I don't know if it's still there or not, but there was a soccer team in Iran back in the days, years ago, called Ararat.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which obviously was a Armenian soccer team.
Right. Yeah. That's my hometown, man.
Yeah, man. Awesome. And so you guys landed in LA. What made you decide, or your parents at that time, to come to America and then to LA?
At the time, Armenia was part of the Soviet Union, and that was towards the end of the fall of the Soviet Union. And my parents knew that there was no hope for us in that regime, in that kind of environment, you know, for the future. My dad had a nephew. My dad had nine siblings. Out of the nine siblings, eight went to Armenia, one stayed in Iran. Mm. And then from Iran, he went to Germany. And then from Germany, they came to the U.S., you know, the usual prison route, you know. Mm-hmm. And then his nephew, my dad's the youngest of nine. And right. His nephew is from the oldest brother. So they grew up together. So my cousin had come here, got a great business set up. He did air conditioning and things like that. And my dad said, look, can you please, you know, help me out, get me over there. So it took a couple of years for us to go through the paperwork. And he wanted, you know, for us just to come and have a better future here, better opportunities at least. So when we came here, I guess I was 10 years old. I didn't speak one word of English. I spoke Armenian and Russian only. Mm. I was miserable, you know, the first couple of months of just, you know, missing. I was a 10-year-old. You miss home. You miss what you're used to, even though there was nothing at home as far as, you know, a great lifestyle, but my whole family was there. You know, I had cousins and everything I knew was in a little small town in Ararat where I was happy not having anything, you know. Mm. And then shortly after we got here, one of my cousins got a job at a pizza place going to hanging out flyers on door to door. And I'll never forget, he was actually a Persian gentleman named Mohammed. He drove a Chevy S10, and there was eight little Armenian 10-year-olds in the back of the truck that he would pick up at the Domino's Pizza, take us to different streets. We run out and hang flyers door to door for his business because he was a franchisee. And we'd get home. When we get back to the shop, he gave us pizza for dinner, and then he'd pay us in quarters, you know, a few dollars here and there. I come home, say, hey, mom, dad, here's some money. Here's a pizza for dinner. And then shortly after, I learned how to read English. And I joined this organization when I was 11 years old to go sell candy door to door. And I just learned how to read. I couldn't speak it. So I would just read this little script, go door to door and sell candy. These little, you know, peanut brittle, big chocolate things were like at the time were $5. I did that for a couple of years. So I had two jobs at the age of 11 when I came here. But I loved it, you know, because I was able to have a little change in my pocket, you know, quarters and dimes and nickels. And I could go and get some ice cream for myself if I wanted to without having to ask my parents, you know, for money. I did that. And then I joined what they, once I learned how to speak English, and I joined the local police departments, what they call the Explorer program, where you're like a junior police officer, because I wanted to be, you know, a police officer. That was my, you know, that was my dream, to be a, you know, a cop in Glendale. And so I joined the Police Explorer program in Glendale. And then I got a, when I turned 16 or sorry, 15, I had a regular job in the mall. So I thought it was really cool because I can, you know, sell sports jerseys and sporting goods store. And played football in high school, did the Explorer program for Glendale Police Department and for the California Highway Patrol. I joined two of them because I wanted to do, you know, as much as possible. And then one day after practice, I was going home. I was home, and then the recruiter from the Marine Corps called me. He's like, hey, you know, my name is Lance Corporal so-and-so. Do you want to be one of the few, the proud of the Marines? I was like, yes, sir. He's like, what? Oh, can you, you're shocked, you know, because most of the time people get hung up on. And so I told my dad, I said, hey, I'm going to go to the recruiting office. He goes, this is the best country in the world. Go serve it. Absolutely go. So I needed, I hated school. I was not, you know, I was the typical football jock and Mr. trying to be a cool guy in school. I didn't want to, I hated school. So I needed 4 years to pass to be a police officer. So I figured if I go do 4 years in the military, that'll get take care of my 4 years. And then I'll be a police officer when I come out of the military. I did that. That was the best decision of my life. And I went to the Marine Corps when I was 17 and I wasn't a citizen yet.
Oh, wow. So you got in there without being a U.S. citizen.
Exactly.
Is that still possible?
It's still possible.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah, you could be a legal resident and join the military. You don't have to be a citizen.
Interesting.
Yeah, I got my citizenship in 2004, April 4th. So I was, I got out of the military in 1999 and then got my citizenship 5 years later.
Wow. Wow, what a journey, man. So what happened from there? You get out of the military and then what happens next?
Yeah, my dream, so when I wanted to stay in the military because I did very well. I got promoted to the rank of sergeant. In the Marine Corps, it takes about 6 years typically. I did it in 2.5 years. And I wanted to still stay in, but I fell in love at a very young age. And I thought I was in love at 19 years old, so I got married, you know. So, and she was a military brat, you know, meaning her father was in the military for 30 plus years. And I wanted to have kids at some point, and the deal was she didn't want to have kids in the military because in a military life, you're constantly traveling every 3 years to a different place. So I decided to get out and pursue to be a police officer. And I went to Glendale Police Department, went through the application process, did everything the way, you know, it was, I was the typical candidate. I'm Armenian. I spoke Armenian. I'm from the, the neighborhood. I was an explorer with them. And to be honest with you, it's, it was a slam dunk thing. I did the physical coming out of the military, was in great shape. I did the written, no problem. I get to the oral interview and there was three people. And one of them, I was an explorer with me when I was in the program. She was 19 and I was 15. I got promoted ahead of her in the explorer program. So she hated my guts. So when I went to the interview, I'm like, oh, hey, what's going on? She's like, oh, it's, you know, my, my rank is this. I was like, oh, I'm sorry. And the at that time when they were scoring, the highest score was 6 points you can get, you know, from each person. When I got the scores, the two sergeants that I've known for a long time gave me all sixes. This particular corporal gave me all fours. So they were hiring three police officers, and that put me at number 17 because she gave me all fours.
Oh, wow.
So when there was a captain, there was a Lieutenant Don Meredith, who I love to this day, got my scores. He goes, when are you going to go to the academy? And I said, well, I didn't make the top three. So he saw the scores. He goes, oh, hell no, we're going to go. Let's go see. I knew the police chief. I knew the police mayor because I was always that also. I would always volunteer in the city to go do neighborhood watch meetings, to go do fire hazard cleanup in the mountains. So I was always involved in some way or shape or form, you know, with the police department, with the city of Glendale. And I was like, you know what? If it's not meant to be, I'm not going to force the issue. I'm not going to go to the chief and the mayor to say, hey, hire me. He goes, no, no, we need you. At the time, there's only two other Armenian officers in the city. He goes, we need Armenians here. He goes, you were an explorer. You know the city. You know our department. You've been here for so many years. We need you. I was like, no, I'm not going to force it. So my friend who was working at a furniture store, he goes, hey, man, come sell furniture. I was like, what the hell is in furniture, dude? You know, I'm used to making when I came to this country, you know, we're on welfare. In the military here, they don't pay. The pay is horrible in the military in the U.S. You know, it's a very low income. And I'm like, listen, man, I can't make money. He goes, just come try it, dude. Like, it's furniture. You have a personality. You can make money here. I said, okay. We gave it a try. And within the second month, I became the number one salesperson in the entire company. Uh-huh. And we had stores across the country. And I'll never forget my first commission check. I went to another Armenian payroll lady, Ada. I go, Ada John, this check you gave me is wrong. Please take it back because I don't want to owe you any money. And she's like, no, it's your page. I'm like, no. I go, listen, I don't want to owe anybody any money. So please take this money back. Give me what I earn. She goes, no, listen, this is what you earned. So congratulations. And so my first full year of selling furniture, I made $117,000.
Wow. Back then.
Yeah, oh, wow. So for me, you know, being a welfare kid, being a military guy, I had never, ever in my life seen that kind of money. So I was like, oh, my God, this is. You know, once this is crazy, you know, you know, I'm rich.
I made it.
Yeah, I didn't know any better. And then I made a little more my second year selling furniture. And then at the time, one of our store managers was moving from California to New Jersey. And back then at that company, the process was you were starting out as a salesperson. And then if you want to go into management, you would go become a merchandiser and then a sales manager and then a store manager. So I called my old boss, the district manager, and I said, hey, Rich, I go, I heard Glenn is leaving to New Jersey. I want to be the store manager. And he's like, are you drunk right now? Are you, what are you smoking? He's like, you're my top guy. And I'm like, no, hold on. Where are you? I'm like, I'm in Glendale. He goes, I'm coming to see you right now. So he comes like a half an hour drive and, you know, he's like, what's this? What do you, I'm like, listen, I know I can sell, but I want to grow and I want to be in a leadership position at some point. And he goes, yeah, but the process is merchandiser, sales manager, and then store manager. I go, I know what the process is, but how do I get there faster? And then, so we talked for a long time and he called our VP. The VP said the same question, thought I was on drugs. You know, I was drinking. He goes, what are you doing? You're going to, because at the time I was making like $125 a year, my second year. And the store manager base pay was $48,000 a year.
Wow.
He goes, you're going to take this massive pay cut. I go, I know, but to me, it's not about the money. It's about opportunity. If I can, you know, have the opportunity, I'll deal with the money part. That'll come in the long term. So, you know, did that for, it was, shoot, about 2 years. I got chosen as being the, at the time, they had what's called the model store, where the model store would have to be the most perfectly organized store, because when they had bankers come in to visit, when they had, you know, visitors come in, they had to come to that store. And as an example, in the furniture store, you know, you had the sofa set, right? You have to have the matching rugs, the matching lamps, the matching picture, the matching plants. The pillows had to have all the zippers on the bottom. The tags had to be four fingers from the edge of the table. It was so regimented. And for me, by having a military background, I'm used to that. In the Marine Corps, we saw, you know, everything has to be aligned. Everything has to be perfect. So I did that for a while. And then the company went through a leadership change. They got merged with another company. And my boss, who was the district manager, got demoted to be, you know, put as a store manager. So now him and I became equals. And then unfortunately, within about a couple of months, he passed away on the sales floor.
Oh, wow.
He was 55 years old. He was Polish, had an Armenian wife. And, you know, we had planned on having New Year's together with, you know, our families. And on December 11th, he passed away. And then they were going to start a new leadership role called an area manager at the time. And then when the new leadership team came from New York, the new boss, Mr. Stuart Kaplan, who today is my mentor, the guy taught me a lot. He comes into our showroom, we start walking in, and he's like, well, tell me your story. What are you doing here? How'd you get this position? And I told him, he goes, what are you, stupid? He goes, and I was like, Jesus Christ. You know, first, I get told I'm like, you know, I'm a drug addict and a drunk because I want to go down. And then I prove myself, and then now I'm being called stupid. He's like, why would you go into management when you make that kind of money? I go, well, it's not about the money for me. You know, it's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after, he goes, hey, we have a new position that we created. It's called area manager. You're going to be the first one. And we're going to have an open house. We're going to have a bunch of hire new people, new positions. You're going to be running it. I was like, oh, I've never done this before, but okay, let's go. Mm-hmm. You know, so we did that. I did that for a couple of years. And then at the age of 25, he helped me, you know, opportunity came up to be a vice president of a region, which was at the time a $250 million volume between Northern California, Arizona, and the Nevada market. And I put my name in the hat for that position. Mm-hmm. They flew me to New York to interview for the role. And I had just had my daughter. My daughter was born on June 5th. And then July 5th, I'm in New York. I get promoted on the spot. He goes, okay, the job is yours. Here's your tickets to Northern California. I was like, oh, I have a 1-month-old at home. I got to, no, you're going to Northern California. So I did that. And I became the VP, one of the youngest VPs, if not the youngest in the company's history at 25. Wow. With that kind of responsibility. And then I did that for a year and became the VP of the year for that year. I was a little over a year. And they had some, I said, challenges, issues with the merger of another company, and things weren't going the way that I liked. Mm-hmm. So I gave my notice and said, you know, we're leaving. Mm-hmm. And then I left. And then 1 year later, the company went out of business.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, not because of me, because they were doing so many changes. I just saw the writing on the wall. Like, okay, I'm not going to be a part of this.
Right. Okay, I have a few questions before we move on with the amazing story. I'm like, wow, what a story. So number one, you know, you come to this country, you don't speak English, you don't know anyone. Everything is new, not only from the environment perspective, but also culture-wise, right? This is everything has been new. So what I feel there is a silver lining through your whole story so far, I've been listening to you, that you're always focused on the next thing and you just keep pushing through no matter what goes on, right? So for me, there is also some sorts of very high confidence that comes with it when you take a step like this, you know, when you leave a paycheck, when you cut your salary from 125 to 40, whatever it was, it comes with a huge confidence that hey, I'm going somewhere, I can make a better future for myself. Where does that come from, man?
I don't know. It's my dad, growing up, my dad, you know, in Ararat was like the youngest of 9 siblings, right? And for Armenian standards at the time, he was a bus driver for tourists that came from America. Mm-hmm. And he was always the risk taker. He was always the one that took care of the family. He was always the one that all his nephews and nieces came to him for whatever they needed, you know, because mm-hmm. we would come back then, you know, being a communist country, being in a small town, a small village, I guess, there was not a lot of opportunities. So when we came back, you know, from taking all these American tourists, I would go with my dad, you know, to all these, churches and all this stuff that, you know, that he was, used to go into, we would come back and say, okay, look, you know, here's $1 to this family, here's $1 to this family, you know, and he would always take care of family. And he was always the one that would take risks, you know, to do whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And that's where I got that from. And because he had instilled so much confidence in me. And being his son, I was like, no, this is, I'm Norik's son, you know, there's nothing that he can't do, you know. So that was the part that I think I got a lot of that from him, you know, is, and he was fearless, you know, when there was an issue, you know, within whatever neighbors and this and that, they'd call my dad, you know, go handle it. And I got to see all that growing up because he was always doing something.
I see.
You know, he was always doing something for somebody else. And he just had that, you know, personality that just didn't, not that he didn't care, just like he was like, I think he didn't, he wasn't caring about, he was fearless. You know, nothing scared him. Nothing.
Right. So you basically had kind of a role model to adapt this from.
Right.
Yeah. Without, probably without even knowing it, you know, you just adapted because he was the one living with you all your life and the one we sons usually look up to, our dads, right?
Exactly. And for him to take his family across the world with nothing, you know, with nothing. So we came here and we had, and I saw him take on jobs that he didn't know how to do. You know, he was a bus driver in Armenia. He comes here as a painter. Right. Since when do you do painting? He does drywall. He does construction, you know, so whatever it took for him to provide for his family, you know, I saw that. I saw the hard work. I saw when he come home from work with paint all over his face, all over his hands, you know, and go over the bathtub with the paint thinner and get the stuff off his fingers and, you know, and still be a dad, you know, that, you know, and still that nothing is impossible, you know, whatever you set your mind to, you got. He came here for opportunities for us to grow. He came for opportunities for our kids to do something. And, you know, my brother got his PhD from USC. My sister is an attorney. You know, my other sister is a banker. You know, so all four of us, he has four kids and we all get along. You know, we're extremely close. And for him to provide that for us, you know, that's how tight-knit we were, you know.
You know, one thing that I also see among immigrants usually is that because they see what their parents go through in order to create the future for them, then it's like, hey, there is no way I'm going to give up on my dreams. I'm going to give up on my vision and goals because my parents went through this, you know, and they didn't come to here for all of us to just me half-ass something, no way. I'm going to go all in and give it all I have.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a huge risk that most people who are born and raised here don't realize.
Absolutely.
The sacrifice it takes for someone to uproot his entire family to go, not across the city, across the country, across the state, across the world, to a place where you don't speak the language, to your point, you don't know the culture, you don't know anything. Hey, go figure it out, you know?
That's one thing. And another thing is also when you get wherever you go as an immigrant, it's like, okay, there is no plan B. That's the only plan I have. I have to make it work, right?
Exactly.
I can't go back. Most of the time they cannot go back because there was something going on back home that made them leave their home country. So now they got here, wherever here is, now they have to make it work because there is no other option left.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the truth. There's no other option. You have no other choice except to find ways to make it happen.
Absolutely.
Legally.
Awesome. Awesome, man. I can't wait. Let's go. So what happened from there? There is now you don't have a job. You're basically, out of your job. Take me through it. What happened from there?
So in the furniture business, I learned that the most profitable category is bedding, mattresses. So in the U.S.,
Is that also where you met Nestor? We have to give a shout out to Nestor, man.
Nestor, for sure. So what happened at Levitt's, the company I was working at, Nestor's brother-in-law and I were high school friends. We went to the military together. I got his brother into the military. I was going, hey, man, let's go to the Marines together. So I got his brother-in-law in.
Okay.
When he got out, I hired his brother-in-law when I was at Levitt's.
Awesome.
And then we started talking. He's like, hey, man, I got my wife's brother, you know, is looking for something. So I met Nestor, and then he was at the time, you know, younger than me by about 5-6 years, but he has energy for days, you know, and got him into at that company as a salesperson. He killed it, you know, and then he did great things when he became a sales manager and then a store manager. That's how I met Nestor, because I knew his sister and I knew his brother-in-law from my high school days. And awesome. He was one, you know.
So shout out to Nestor for making this happen. Thank you for introducing Henrik to me. That's awesome, Nestor. Thank you so much. So please go on, Henrik.
So because the betting category was such high margins, mm-hmm. I wanted to open up my own betting store. Mm-hmm. So I started going around and looking at locations, you know, because I knew I could make money selling mattresses because their margin is ridiculous. So mm-hmm. anybody listening, when you buy a $4,000 mattress, it's, you know, the cost of that is, it's ridiculous, right?
Right.
So during my research, I ran into a company called Sleep Number. They make mattresses that have the adjustable mm-hmm. bed where you can, you know, make your side firm, the other side soft. And I checked the company out and I'm like, this is a pretty cool product. This is a pretty cool, it's a big company. They were a $1 billion company. And I was like, well, let me try to apply with them. Mm-hmm. So I got on board with them and I became a market manager with them. So when I, because of my experience, I went interview, they gave me a territory in LA that I managed for, you know, about two and a half years I was with them. And I did, you know, I think I did well, according to them, I did well, because I would get chosen to go, if there was a district manager or market manager that was, you know, a market that was void of a manager, someone had left, I would go cover that market. I covered Seattle market, I covered San Diego market, Orange County market when it was needed. And then this company to this day, I think is, if not the, well, in my experience, the best company I've ever been a part of.
Wow.
They're so organized. Their CEO, Shelly Ibach, is an amazing woman who just, she's a visionary. She's amazing. As an organization, they're so well run. I mean, it's an amazing company.
Mm-hmm.
And for someone like my personality, it's, I like controlled chaos where mm-hmm. let me fix something, you know, let me go in there, fix something. Let me, if there's a problem, I'll go fix it. If there's an issue, I'll handle it. And about 2.5 years in, I get a call from this current company. He's like, hey, you know, we got your, based on your experience from the furniture business, because we opened up a lot of stores in a short period of time, this company is going to be expanding and they need someone like you to come in to help with that growth. I was like, no, you know what? I love Sleep Number. They're a great company. I'm comfortable here. I'm okay. I get the call the next day from the recruiter. She goes, no, listen, like, you should come talk to him. Like, it's, at least talk to him. I go, but it's like cheating on my company. I don't want to, you know, I'm happy here. They take care of me. I'm good here. She goes, just at least talk to them. And then when I went interviewed with Barbecues Galore, the gentleman who was my boss at the time, Rob Barnes, who was another military guy, Navy guy, one of the brightest people I've ever met in my life. The guy's just, he's amazing. He's doing great things with the $40 billion company. I spoke with him. I was the first interview at first thing in the morning. And at the time, they were hiring two people for Arizona, San Diego, and one for LA area. And during the process, I was like, listen, I can do both territories. And he's like, are you serious? I'm like, look, I go, if you're doing the volume, this was at the time, like a $30 million territory. I'm like, I've done $250 million territory in three states. Mm. I can do $30 million in, you know, a couple of states. Give me a chance to, you know, I go, I'm not trying to sound arrogant, but it doesn't seem like a lot. Mm-hmm. And I was the first interview. He's like, damn it. Now we got to sit all the other interviews, you know, to go through it. Because the company at the time was planning on opening up stores, planning on going public, planning on this huge expansion.
Mm.
So I'd like that challenge. And at the time, I was like hesitant on leaving Sleep Number. But like, you know what? This is a good challenge because now I can see if they go public, potential to make a lot of money when they go public is going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to have my own stamp on the growth of this business.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined them on March 3rd, 2008, and I got about 15 people from Sleep Number and my Levis days that when they find out, hey, we want to come with you. So I brought them on board. And then on April 23rd, a month and a half later, we have a meeting. And then at the time, the CEO was like, okay, here's what's going on. We're going to have to do layoffs. And I was like, wait a second. Like, what do you mean? I just brought all these people here with me. And then now we're doing, what happened to the story about we're going to go public, we're going to open up so many stores, we're going to, this thing's going to be massive, this and that. He's like, yeah, it's not working out that way because the company who owned us was an Australian private equity firm, was pulling out.
Oh, wow.
So the people that came with me, now I couldn't, you know, I have to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And then in August, the company filed Chapter 11.
Wow.
So my old company found out, and then they called, say, you want to come back? I was like, you know what? I made my bed. I got to lay in it because the people that I brought with me, I can't abandon them now.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever happens, happens. I'm going to ride this thing through.
Mm-hmm.
And so within a year of me getting hired, the gentleman that hired me, the VP, ends up leaving. And he was the rock. He was like, you know, he was just an amazing, amazing, such a bright, just amazing man. So they promoted me to be the VP after a year of being here.
So that's before they filed bankruptcy, right?
After the bankruptcy, he left.
After the bankruptcy,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, after the bankruptcy, he left.
Gotcha.
And then I took over as a VP.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year later, the owner was going to close the company. The guy who bought the company out of bankruptcy,
gotcha.
He had kept the same regime in place.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing was, you know, I found out later they had lost $16 million that year. That, but as a VP of retail, all I knew was the sales side. I didn't mm-hmm. have access to the operations end of it. I was just told, you go sell, we'll take care of the money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, I knew my role, had to do what I had to do. And so one day, just by, you know, chance, we're in San Diego and the old CEO is like, hey, the owner is going to go back to Taiwan, take him to the airport to LAX. Yes, sir. It's a 2-hour drive. I'll do it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that 2-hour drive to LAX, we happened to stop by in Irvine for sushi. Right.
Right.
And at the time, I didn't know. I never had sushi.
Right.
So the owner was like, you know, you like sushi? I'm like, yes, sir. Oh my God, I'm going to die. You know, so we go to this sushi place that because he used to live in Irvine. And it just, things happen that to me, you know, there's something above that controls 100%. Everything. And we go into the sushi place and I'm like, okay, I'm going to die. Listen, we eat meat. You know,
right.
If he has 4 feet, 4 legs, we're eating it. You know, if it swims, I'm kind of questionable. And we're sitting in the waiting lounge. And then these two ladies come in, and this one lady looks at the owner with like this death look, right? And I was like, this is weird. And he goes, okay, we must leave. I was like, oh, okay. Where are we? I go, that's my ex-wife. He goes, I can't be here with her. So I'm like, okay, cool. Thank God. We're going to go and have some hot food, you know? And so I went to a Thai place, and that 2-3 hour time with them, he asked me about my life, where I come from. And he had a very similar upbringing. He grew up on a small village. He grew up, you know, just very, very similar. You know, he's almost twice my age, but, you know, we had similar stories. So we connected there very well. And so after my second year with the company, my first year as a vice president, he was going to close the company. So he sent his sister, who was the CEO of another company in the States. She came in and they were going to let this gentleman go. And then plan on closing the business because they're just losing too much money.
Mm-hmm.
And my stupid butt tells the, you know, assistant, I go, before you do that, I have an idea. And I go, why don't you let me try to fix this for 1 year? And I go, I don't want any extra money. So what I'm making now, leave the money the same. And I go, you be the finance person because you're the owner's sister. So you can take care of your brother.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be the COO for now.
Mm-hmm.
Let me run. Give me access to all the books. Give me access to what's happening with the business. And then you be the CEO. You do the executive portion of it, the finance portion of it. Let me do everything else. And please give me a chance to fix it. And she's like, wow. You know, I've never done it before. I've never been in that position before. And then she talks to her brother. He goes, you know what? I like this guy. Let's give him a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Let's give him a year. And then from there, you know, I got access to all the financials and I started, and I'm not an educated guy, but I know enough. I can read a P&L. I can read, you know, I can see the books and see where we're losing money, where we're making money, what opportunities are. So I get the financials and I'm going through, you know, it's not rocket science. Look at the red, you know, if it's red.
Make
why
the
is
red,
it red
green.
Exactly. Why is it red? Okay. What's that line, Adam? Oh, wow. We're paying this for this. We're paying this for this. Oh my God. Right, because the money was coming in, but just being spent in bad places. So we had a lot of fat that was in the company. You know, we had a CFO who was an Oxford graduate. Okay, that's great, but you're going bankrupt.
Right.
You know, we had VPs everywhere. We had VPs of this business and that business, where we don't need to have that many VPs. Mm. And the people that were doing the work weren't being recognized for it.
Mm.
So I laid off, I did a $5 million payroll cut in the first month.
Wow.
And then I got bashed on all the blogs. Oh, this guy's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's going to ruin the company. He's going to do this. I gave him 3 months. They'll be out of business. Because our company was known back then of, you know, we had our own delivery drivers, our own trucks. Everything was in-house.
Mm-hmm.
That's great to have. That mm-hmm. was all, you know, fine and dandy. But we're, you know, seasonal business. We know where our peak months are between April and about August. The rest of the months were... it's pretty slow because mm-hmm. people aren't outside barbecuing and mm-hmm. entertaining because it's cold. And so I did a few things that I took from my old company, the ideas that they had, and I outsourced the delivery company.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was like, oh my God, that's it. He's going to kill the company. But when I outsourced the company that I work, you know, with, I said, listen, I'll give you our business, but you got to hire my guys. Because they have the experience, because they're dealing with gas lines, they're dealing with, you know, installation in customers' homes. So you can keep them busy mm-hmm. in our slow months. So we did that, and because we were paying, I think at the time, $65,000 a month for lease payments on trucks that were parked most of the time. We had technicians who were paying, you know, good money to, that were sitting around in the winter months just sweeping the warehouse because they're mm-hmm. not. So I go to the warehouse. I'm like, hey, what's Barry doing? Oh, just sweeping. That's it. Yeah. What's mm-hmm. also, oh, just they're hanging out, they're wiping the windows, you know, just things to do because there's nothing for them to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we did, you know, a few things like that and started cutting it back, reshuffling, you know, reprioritizing some of our stuff. And within, when I first took over, we had lost $16 million the year before. And then by second year, we became profitable.
Wow.
And it was not because of my, you know, genius ideas. It was we put the right people in the right places. You know, those guys and girls who were doing the work mm-hmm. before that weren't being recognized for it, or they, you know, they weren't being pushed the right way. You know, I gave all these people an opportunity to say, listen, you've been doing the work. I know, I've seen you do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're going to be recognized for it. And here's, you're going to do it with a lot less resources.
Mm-hmm.
So we cut the VP, cut this, cut that, cut that. It's your show. We went from, you know, as an example, we had five people in our buying department. We're down to one. We had five people in our HR department, down to one.
Mm-hmm.
We had five people in marketing, down to one. You know, we just cut back, took care of the ones that were left, paid them well, treated them well, gave them all the freedom in the world to do what they had to do because they knew, you know, what it was that needed to be done to move forward, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I mean, we have people in our warehouse, in our stores, in our office that are with us for, Rogelio has been 26 years.
Wow.
You know, a bunch of people, 26, 20, 18, 20, there's all these people have stuck with us throughout time. Because my thing is, you know, look, I run the company as a pyramid, but I'm on the bottom.
Mm.
You know, our salespeople are at the top of the pyramid. That's the most important. That's the front lines. That's who talks to the customers every single day. That's who interacts with them every single day. So whatever they need to be successful, our job is to take care of them. So when I go to do store visits, I don't go to the store visit as a CEO to come in and start, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad. I genuinely, sincerely, when I go, you know, go to the stores, okay, what do you guys need? You know, what are we doing wrong? How can we get better? And if they have a concern, pick up the phone. Call that department. Hey, I'm in this store. Here's what they need. Please get it done. And it's done. And they're like, oh, okay. I can talk to this guy. I can tell him the truth. You know, I can tell him what's happening. Because a lot of times with CEO visits, it's a dog and pony show, right? People are walking in CEO. They have to put on this fake, you know, oh, everything is great. You know, yay, we're so happy.
Right.
You know? But I want to tell me the truth. Because if I don't know the truth, I can't fix it. If you BS me and saying, hey, everything is great, then we're not going to get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we started doing things like that, and it's been, you know, good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's ups and downs like any business, you know, but the most important thing is the family we have in that business sticks together. And when the stores call our office, people jump. When an associate who's the most important person in our company says something, when I go to a store, I truly say, I'm here for you. So what do you need? Tell me the truth. Don't BS me. at first it was hard for them to get used to it because they're like, oh, we're used to coming and getting shit on. You know, they used to call it seagull management, right? Seagulls, when they fly, they shit on you and they leave, and they were used to, you know, in a certain extent, that kind of leadership. Mm-hmm. I'm like, reverse, where it's, we work for you. Now it's, you know, they're in charge. Without them, without the people in the stores, we're nothing. Mm-hmm. We're absolutely nothing, because you can have the best product, you can have the best marketing, have people coming through your doors, and if you have somebody who's bitter, who's upset, who's not happy in the store level, that pisses the customer off, all that money is wasted, gone out the door. You know, so we have, and then the stores, we cut down on the amount of people to allow them to make more money. Mm-hmm. You know, we cut down the amount of stores. It's like in some markets, we used to have 6 stores. They were like 8-9 miles apart. Like Phoenix is an example. You know, we had 6 stores and we were doing like $7 million a year with 6 stores. We cut down to 2 stores. We're doing $8 million with 2 stores.
Wow. So when you took over, how many, when you became the COO, as you said back then, how many stores did you guys have?
At that time, 44.
44. Mm-hmm. And then you cut down and closed stores?
Closed stores. Yeah, closed markets. Like in Northern California, we had stores up there. But Northern California market was just, we couldn't. There's not enough margin in our product. People assume that you make all this money selling. Like, no. Grills have a very low margin. Appliances in general.
Oh, wow.
It's very low margin. And the pay in Northern California, as an example, Palo Alto, it was a good store. Mm-hmm. But they advertise, you know, those guys who hold a sign saying,
right,
you know,
show up here.
Those guys are getting paid $25 an hour.
Oh, wow.
Well, we're paying, you know, 18 bucks an hour plus commission. Mm. But somebody can sit there and hold a sign,
right,
for $25 an hour. And so you couldn't get enough pay for the associates. I could pay them enough, but I would lose money. So we try to keep up with the pay structure, which we did, but then the stores were losing money like crazy. So we closed Palo Alto market, Northern California market. We closed the Southern Texas market, kept Dallas, because logistically the cost became too much for us to, because a low margin product, it became too much for us to be profitable in all those markets. So we just concentrated on what is the best market, what do we have the most amount of stores or the right amount of stores that could be successful with the, you know, because we had, at the time we had, when I first took over, we had 4 warehouses. I closed that into 1 warehouse just to cut down on some of the logistics costs, and then also be more efficient, because when we were buying goods, we have to buy it for 4 different warehouses. Mm. And then one warehouse would sell off faster than the other. Now we're paying it to go from this warehouse to that warehouse. So when I close all those warehouses, open up one big distribution center in California, everything came there. And then from there, we're able to send it to each stores individually so they can, you know, be more efficient. And it made the buying process much easier. Now I have a buyer buying for one warehouse. And then we had our systems upgraded, and because I would go to the, you know, our buyers, okay, what do you need? And he goes, right now, everything is manual. I sit there and look at every single store every single day, what they need, this and that. So we, you know, got the program and said, look, here's what we need. We gave it to him in plain English. Mm-hmm. I need to know, you know, what we call up, you know, our PSI, mm-hmm. right? Our product, and then our sales, our inventory. And then started having the system do a lot of work for us, which back then they didn't have that. You know, it was all done manual, mm-hmm. and human error can be caused, you know, very easily. Mm-hmm. So just streamline the processes and things like that, and take care of our associates, take care of our staff, our support system, and let the company, you know, run like a family run business. And if people are working for each other, you get a lot more done versus working for yourself and saying, okay, what can I do to improve myself? No, if you work for somebody else and you work together, you get a lot more things done a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. I love that, man. And you know, I was talking to someone else this week who was talking about how you treat a family like a business. And now in your case, I'm seeing how you treat business like a family, which is super strong to have in a structure like in a business environment, that you treat everyone basically like family. And they, I assume, they go over and beyond because they feel this kind of belonging.
They do. It's so true. It's I owe a lot to the owner of the company because he could have dumped the company a long time ago. Mm-hmm. He's a very, very wealthy man. You know, he doesn't need this business. Mm-hmm. He has much other business that he can, you know, he can dump this one, forget about it. Wow. You know, but for him to trust me enough to say, look, and he leaves me alone. He calls me once every 2 or 3 months. He says hello, asks me how my kids are, mm-hmm. how are we doing. He asks me, what do you need from me? Mm-hmm. I'm like, just do what you do, sir, and you know, we're good. Mm-hmm. And so I'm grateful to him for mm-hmm. allowing, at the time I was 31 years old, for allowing wow. a 31-year-old to run his company with no previous CEO experience. So he gave that trust to me as a father, as his own son, right? So I owe that to him. So that's the way mm-hmm. I, you know, take care of the business. And we have associates who will, you know, it seems petty, but like my operations manager, Claudia, she'll look at all the FedEx bills. And even if there's a $5 overcharge, she'll fight them. Mm. You know, even if it's $1.50, hey, why is there a discrepancy? Because where there's $1.50, there could be 100 of those, you know, mm-hmm. those add up. You know, we have other places, you know, in our company where our warehouse manager, Eric, another former Marine, you know, will find ways to, you know, reduce costs, not by cutting corners and things like that, but looking at it from if this is my business, it's my family business, what can I do to make my family stable? Mm-hmm. You know, and when we have on our office, when we have birthdays, we know we all sing happy birthday, we bring a cake to each other. When we have potlucks, you know, those people who want to pray will get together. Like, if you guys want to pray, you know, be thankful for this, cool. If not, you know, you don't have to. We just do things where, because we spend most of the time together mm-hmm. in the office. We're there for 8, 9 hours, 10 hours a day together. Mm-hmm. And then you go home to your family and then you put the kids to bed, you go to bed. And you come mm-hmm. back the next day, you're with the same people, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of life I want to have. Work, family lifestyle. Come home, you know, have family lifestyle. So I'm not sitting there saying, I got to go to work. Like, I love going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it's not a chore. It's not like, I got to go to work shit. No, it's, mm-hmm. I can't wait to go see, you know, so-and-so's having a baby. So-and-so has this, so-and-so, you know. And like on a sad portion, we had one of our managers whose son had brain cancer. And the way the group came together, you know, the way the group came together of the support that everyone showed to this, you know, to this gentleman and his child. It was a 10-year-old kid who had cancer. And like how you can only get that through like a family vibe, you know, the family feeling where everybody came together and was, whether they were sending flowers, whether it was calling, whether it was checking, hey, I got, you know, go take off, you know, we'll cover your, you know, your work while you're gone, go take care of your son, you know, things like that, that makes going to work a, you know, treat versus, you know, dreading it, which a lot of companies do.
That's so powerful, man. Where does that come from? Where do you get that from? Where did you learn that? Where did you adapt to that?
Coming from a family of, so my uncle, well, my cousin, I call him uncle because he's my dad's nephew, but he's my dad's age, the one that brought us here. He did a family tree, or tried to. On my dad's side alone, we have 1,500 cousins. Wow. At 5 levels. Mm-hmm. And in Armenia, there was, you know, my dad had, there was eight of them. My mom had 5 in her family. Each of those 8 had 4 to 10 kids. And my mom's side had 2 to 4 kids. My mom's side is a little more calm. You know, they didn't have as many kids as my dad's side.
They had TVs.
Right. We were always together with the family. We were always together, you know, and like my days in Armenia was spent, me and my cousins would go to my uncle's house and then my aunt's house and then my other uncle's house. And then it was always family get-togethers. My aunt she had animals and she would bake the bread. You know, my dad would bring this, my other uncle would bring this. So we're always doing family things. And that's where I grew up. You know, that's what built me to the person I am is I was always around family. And it's always you do whatever it takes for family. You know, and the work-wise, you know, my dad's best friend was his coworker. So we were always, you know, at their house, they were at our house. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, ingrained in me from a young age of how important a family is. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a good family, everything else will fall in place because family takes care of each other. You know, there's the other side, right? People who have family drama, That us, we never had that. And that's why it was always love. It was always, you know, happiness. So I took that as, you know, as a child, I learned that. And all I was doing all my life was family, family, family.
That's so amazing, man. Especially in today's world, in the business world, it's such a rare thing to find. You know, people like yourself who are leader of a company and still treated like a family unit. It's absolutely such a rare thing to find.
It's who loves you more, you know, besides family, right? Family wants the best for you. You know, when my sister became an attorney, I started crying. I was so happy. My brother got his PhD. I was the happiest guy in the world. My brother get his PhD, proud, and, you know, and them with me, vice versa. You know, so when you have family that loves each other, they will do whatever it takes for each other. You know, and that's how it should be in business. If you, if you're in a business, that's your work family. That's, you know, I work for my people. I work for my coworkers, for my, you know, all the people that work in our business, our warehouse associates, to our salespeople, to our, you know, store managers, everybody in the office. That's my, my, I wouldn't say I have stress, but my constant thought is, what can I do not to F this up? Because if I F this up, I'm going to affect them. And I can't affect them because so-and-so just had a baby. So-and-so has, you know, three kids. So-and-so has a kid in college. So-and-so has, you know, a kid who's getting married. You know, I got to make sure that I do my job to make sure that they have a steady income to take care of their families.
That's amazing, man. I, you know, this is something so many, so many business owner and leaders can adapt, and yeah, absolutely. So how many stores do you guys have now?
We have 17 now.
17 now. And how often do you visit these stores?
As often as possible. I hate being in the office. I go to the office on Mondays, you know, but usually throughout the week. I was in a store yesterday. I was in a store the day before that. I try to go to stores. I mean, I'm in the stores at least 1 or 2 days a week. And it's just, when I go to the stores, it's more, I love that, it's to see our people, right? Also talk to the customers. What are they coming in? What are they asking for? You know, what's the, because we can sit there and look at stats and, you know, reports and studies. Studies show, okay, great. But what I'm seeing is different than the real life. You know, so you don't get that from a study. Because I'll get reports from companies, hey, do you want to see a report for the industry? Okay, I'd love to see it. I see it. And industry is showing that, blah, blah, blah. Customers asking for this. Okay, cool. I go to their stores. I see real customers and hear the conversation. Ask them what brought them in. Why are they doing this? Why are they buying this? Why do they want to do this? And that helps me with, you know, making decisions and ideas from the team to get better. You know, so I'm in the stores at least twice a week, if not more.
And you guys have stores all over the U.S., right?
Now we're, we have 4 stores in Dallas. We have 2 in Phoenix, 1 in Las Vegas, and the other 10 are in Southern California between San Diego and L.A. County, North County.
I see. You know, when I listen to you and how you treat everything and your business and obviously family as a business, how much also does that from the operations side, does that, has that to do with your military background?
It's it has to be a lot because I have OCD issues, right? I gotta have things that, you know, I'm very, when it comes to certain things, it has to be squared away. Like, it has, things have to be aligned, things have to be, you know, in place. On the operations side, one of the things that was a challenge in the beginning was our partner relationships, you know, with our vendors. Before there was more, there was a lot of this, you know, I guess bad history prior to my time. And to establish that is, I want to do right by our partners. You know, just because we have terms with somebody doesn't mean we take advantage of those terms and get to the max. So one of the things I kept doing with our accounting teams, okay, look, like every single day to this day, for the last 16 years, I want to know every day, what do we have in our bank? You know, what is our accounts payable? And what's our terms, right? And as of today's, what, Wednesday? On Monday, I don't owe any debt to anybody because even though we have terms with people, right? We might have 60-day terms with somebody. The only debt we have is to our parent company for, you know, our own product. But that's, you know, that's part of our business. But everybody else, you know, I might have 60-day terms with somebody and I pay them in 7.
Wow.
Because there's going to be a time where I'm going to need them. which did happen when COVID happened, because of those all those years of good, you know, relationship we've had with them. At the, you know, in the beginning, I didn't know what COVID was going to do. Okay, what's this new COVID thing? They want to shut us down. I can't shut us down. We have people that rely on that. You know, we're in California, and people can't afford to be on the government assistance program and live. They have to pay rents. They have to pay car payments. They have to buy, you know. So I reached out to a vendor, said, listen, I haven't asked you for anything. I've always paid you ahead of time based on our terms. Help me out in this next 3 months. I want to pay you still within those terms. I know you used to for the last 10 years, me paying you early. But I don't want to hear, hey, where's your payment? I don't want to hear we're going to hold product back, because if you're going to be scared of COVID, I'm scared too, but I got to figure out how to fix this. And each vendor's like, take whatever you need. If you go past the terms, no problem. We didn't go past any terms, luckily, but I knew that because of what we've built over the last, you know, 14, 15 years, there was trust between our operations partners, our, you know, manufacturers, that I can reach out to them when there's a need and say, hey, man, help me out. I'm not going to pay you like I have been, you know, but I'm going to pay you on time. I just, it might be a little longer, so don't give me shit. And that came, you know, it's the military, I think, has a lot to do with it. But I've always been like this, even when I was a teenager. I've always had, like, I used to go, this was by necessity when I was my middle school. We didn't have money. I was broke, as you know, we were an immigrant. You know, I only had a certain amount of clothes. And I used to write down, okay, this for this week, I'm wearing this shirt with this pants. And then this shirt, then I would put next week, this shirt with different pants. So I don't have the same clothes every week. You know, so I'd always write stuff down and make sure that my you know, my outfit was set up a month in advance. So I knew exactly what date, what shirt, what pants. So I've always been that way. It's and the military helped get that to a different level, where it's always like, hey, structure, structure, structure. And that's how I'm wired that way. Now my kids, my 8-year-old, when he's 10 now, when I first got divorced and moved out, when he came to my house, got up in the morning, hey buddy, is your bed made? What? I'm 8 years old, bro. What do you mean? Right. I'll be sure I have a good bed. You know, so he knows now, don't leave my house without bed being made. You know, when you walk out the door, make sure you got your dress nice, your hair's done, brush your teeth. It's and he's 10 now, and he's got a routine. He's got a structure.
I love that. Just the way it should be, man. Just the way it should be. Absolutely. Absolutely. Man, it's been such an amazing conversation, but I know you're a busy guy. I want to respect your time. And a couple of things I actually noted during our conversation that I want to give back to you. Just the feedback. You're such a positive guy. I actually realized, talking about all your past experiences, you always talked positive about the people that came into your life, business life, you had something to do with them. Every time you mentioned someone, you talked positively about them. That's number one. Number two, you're a man of honor, man. I haven't seen you. This is just the second time we're talking to each other, but that much I can tell, you're a man of honor. I think the world needs more people like you.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And yeah, man, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving value to our audience, sharing your amazing story. It's been an honor having you on, and it was a big pleasure talking to you. And yeah, thank you so much from my heart.
Thank you. It's my honor to be here. I'm very thankful to you for taking the time and, you know, doing this. I appreciate it very much. It's an absolute pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Henrik.
Yes, sir. Thank you.